Before we deal with wisdom, just a few more words about dhyana. We've dealt with dhyana in the sense of the higher states of consciousness, the superconscious states. But we now have to deal with the second great meaning of dhyana, dhyana in the sense of the practices leading to these higher states of consciousness. But we're going to be very, very brief here. We could, of course, explain the five basic meditation exercises, could speak at length of the preparations for meditation, could describe the experiences or some of the experiences occurring in the course of practice. But we've no time for all that. And in any case, these topics have been dealt with on a number of other occasions before. Today, I'm going to limit myself just to one observation under this heading. And that is that dhyana, in the sense of the experience of superconscious states, is a natural thing. A natural thing. Ideally, as soon as one goes into the meditation room, whether it's the shrine at Sakura or a corner of one's own house, as soon as one goes there, as soon as one sits down, as soon as one crosses one's legs, as soon as one closes one's eyes, as soon as one does all this, one should go straight into dhyana. It should be as natural, it should be as easy as that. In fact, we may say that if we led a truly human life, if we had spent the previous day or the previous week, the previous month, the previous year properly, this might well happen. No reason why it shouldn't happen. That as soon as we sit down, cross our legs, close our eyes, we just go quite naturally into the dhyana state, the superconscious state. But I hardly need tell you, it seems almost cruel to mention it, that this is not what happens. We all have to strive and to struggle and to sweat and sometimes to swear under our breath and to feel disappointed and it isn't worth the effort, that we are making fools of ourselves and we might just as well be at the cinema or watching the television and so on. So this is what usually happens. We have to strive and struggle. But strive and struggle to do what? We don't have to strive and struggle to meditate. No. We don't have to strive and struggle to get into the dhyana state. No. Not that. We have to strive and struggle to remove the obstacles. We have to strive and struggle to remove, for example, the five mental hindrances. If we could only remove them, then we go sailing at least into the first dhyana. So most of what we call meditation exercises do not lead directly to higher states of consciousness. They simply help us remove the obstacles. Concentrate on mindfulness of breathing, it removes the obstacle of distraction. Concentrate on the metta bhavana, it removes the distraction of ill will. So just remove the obstacles with the help of these methods, and then the higher states, or at least the first of the higher states, will naturally manifest themselves. Now, the Bodhisattva does not simply practice dhyana, meditation. The Bodhisattva practices dhyana paramita, the perfection of meditation, transcendental meditation. In other words, he practices meditation so as to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all. He doesn't practice it for the sake of his own peace of mind, though that comes. He doesn't practice it so that he may go to heaven, though even that may come if he wants. He practices meditation, he practices dhyana as one aspect of the path which will lead him one day to enlightenment supreme enlightenment for the benefit of all. Finally, we may say that the bodhisattva's practice of meditation does not exclude external activity. In our case, if we want to meditate, we have to stop external activities. We can't do both at the same time. We have to retire. We have to find a quiet place, a quiet corner. We have to sit still. We have to close our eyes, cross our legs, and all the rest of it. But the bodhisattva is practicing something much greater, something much higher. But the bodhisattva is able, or should be able, to do both simultaneously. And the scriptures stress this very, very much in a number of places, that internally he should be immersed in dhyana, but externally carrying on various activities. Not that he suffers from a sort of partial schizophrenia or anything like that. What appear to us to be two contradictory things in the case of the bodhisattva are one thing. The activity is the external aspect of the inner meditation. The inner meditation is the inner dimension of the external activity, the two sides of a single coin, as it were. So this is how the bodhisattva practices meditation. He practices it as not excluding external activity. So this, of course, should eventually be our aim too, but in the meanwhile we mustn't delude ourselves, and we have to recognize that for us, for a very, very long time to come, meditation will exclude external activity. External activity will exclude meditation, even though we should certainly try to see that the effects of our meditation experience, persist and carry over into our everyday life and activities. But it will be a very, very long time before we can meditate, just as we meditate at our best on our meditation cushion when we're in the midst of the traffic, when we're washing up, and so on. But that should be our ultimate aim.